Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Dana Glauberman, ACE, and Nathan Orloff about their work on Ghostbusters Afterlife. I last spoke to Dana, along with the rest of the editing team, for The Mandalorian, and spoke with her before that for Creed 2. Dana was nominated for Ace Eddies for Thank You for Not Smoking, Juno, Up in the Air, Young Adult, and The Mandalorian. Other films in her filmography include Draft Day, Labor Day, and No Strings Attached. Nathan Orloff's filmography includes Plan B and work as an additional or associate editor on The Front Runner, Tully, and 10 Cloverfield Lane. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. My audience broke into applause, I have to say. I watched an IMAX theater Thursday night, opening night, basically. And
oh, great.
I just want to talk about comic timing and what it means. One of my favorite comic timings was maybe it's the apocalypse, and then there's a music cue. And the music cue just hit perfectly. So talk to me about those editorial punchlines of somebody says something funny, and then usually there's a cut to another video, there's a cut to another scene. Talk to me about finding that exact right moment.
Jason has a way with comedic timing that is just so spot on and beautiful. And I've learned so much from him and learned so much from working with his dad and through the many years of different experiences. For me, there's no right or wrong. It's really just a feel. And sometimes you have to play with that. And when you see something that you like, you buy it. To me, it's that kind of instinct. It's almost like a 1-2-3 punch. It's like beat, 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 and then you go. So you have to sort of time it that way too.
Totally makes sense. Nathan, did you have any of those that were, I don't know, like a punchline? I always think of somebody saying something funny and you cut to the next scene. And in a funny movie, that always seems to be very specifically timed, that cut to the next scene after a joke.
I just thought of something else to add. Sorry, yeah. Nate. something that I learned that has really stuck to me, and I've said this to Nate a million times. Were you going to say this?
I was thought about saying it, and I was like, no, I got to let her say it because it's her thing.
You know, same brain. I was told as an assistant many times, as an assistant for Ivan and Shelley Kahn and Wendy Brickmont, always put a comma after a scene, not a period. And that has a lot to do with the comedic timing too. So when you're trying to sell comedy, you don't necessarily want to end the scene on a pause. You want to put a comma on and just keep on going. So that's the comma period difference. And that has always stuck to me. And in all of my years of, God, I'm talking like I am a million years old. but in my many years of experience, I've always explain that to my assistants and my co-editors. And, you know, it's just something that has always stuck with me. And I think it's always stuck with them as well. Put a comma after a scene, particularly in comedy, rather than a period.
And now it's stuck with me.
That's perfect. And before I let Nathan answer whatever he was going to answer, just for those that might not understand exactly what you mean by a comma and a period, it's a way to keep the energy going, right? Because
yes,
a period would be the end of the scene, the end of the energy, and then you've got to start back up again, right?
Exactly.
And actually, to on this perfect subject, is in that scene when she said, maybe it's the apocalypse, she winked after that. Like originally in the original version of the movie, winking was a thing that her mom told her to do. Maybe you should wink, it'll let people know you're kidding. And when you simplify and trim, you simplify it. And we experimented even late putting that back, where she said that and then winked. And then Dana was completely right. It was funny, and it actually was funny, but it didn't keep the energy up, and you're like begging for more laughs when you just had a great one and you just need to keep going and the movie's better for it.
Ah, that's very interesting. And she does wink once, right? She tells a triangle joke, right?
Right, which that's why it was diminishing returns. It was like, we already just did it.
Yeah. It's a very deliberate wink. It's adorable and very funny. Yeah.
She sells it so good. She was so much fun to work with. And we shot this 2 years ago. We started production July of 2019. Finished production in what, October?
Yeah, like almost
home. In October, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And she was just a kid then. And looking at her now, 2 years later, I mean, she's blossomed into a young woman who is just so vibrant and happy and such a good actress.
Yeah.
So.
On that note of comedic timing, though, there's this really interesting thing I remember listening to when people talked about working on Avatar with James Cameron. And they were talking about design of Pandora and whatnot. And they're like, unlike films where it's like coming up with stuff in this pre-production phase, James has been there. And we're just trying to figure out and be these archaeologists that are digging into his brain to pull that out. Because he's been there. And Jason's a little bit like that with performance, with character, and some of this and timing. A lot of this stuff is just in his brain. And we just have to figure out how to get there. And it's this uncovering of once it's there, it's great. It just feels this wonderful feeling. But it's all Jason and his sensibilities are just unlike anyone I've ever worked with.
100%. Couldn't agree more.
I love it. So do you feel like in that idea of getting into his brain that he knows the exact moment that he wants to cut after the wink or before the wink?
In some instances, I'd say yes.
Other times it's more about he knows exactly how he wants to feel and we have to figure out how to do that.
Yep. Mm. And no discussions before that. I know a lot of directors might not do that. Some might say, hey, you know, what's the intent? But you guys are kind of left on your own. You figure it out. And if you don't, you know, maybe you'll come up with something cool. Otherwise, I'll step in and as the director and tell you what I want.
This is my 7th feature with Jason. I think 8th project if you count the TV show that we did, not counting the short films that I helped him out on before Thank You for Smoking. So he has never really brought me to set because he wants me as an editor to kind of go about things with a fresh eye perspective. He doesn't necessarily want me being tainted or influenced by anything that I see or hear on set. And so he kind of leaves me to my own devices. And then once he's done with production, then we can collaborate. And sometimes I come up with great ideas that he never thought of, and it'll stick that way. Other times I'm totally off the trail and we have to rework things together. But we shot this in Calgary. I went up to Calgary for the first couple of days of production just to sort of be there. And then Nate actually went up and did a lot of work on set with them while I stayed back in LA and just continued working on other things. So I think it was helpful for Jason with you there, Nate.
Yeah, what was the value of having you there, Nathan?
Pivoting exactly on what Dana just mentioned is that having that fresh eye perspective is a perfect use case and perfect execution of, I think, what his process is and works well. But this is his first movie with big special effects in action. And that requires more planning. I haven't worked on all the films that Dana obviously has worked on, but I can imagine this might be the first movie he's ever worked on where he shot one part of a scene with this different unit, and then shot main unit a different scene, and then 2 months later during a soundstage finishing the scene. So this would be the first time he had these piecemeal things. And this one sequence in particular, I mean, there's the whole third act was in particular as well, but the chase sequence in the middle of the movie, I worked on the storyboards before shooting. And so then they did second unit in the summertime when the weather was perfect for it. And so then I would add these second unit shots, and then I would cut to a storyboard. And so then I went up to Calgary for when they were shooting stuff on the stage for like filling in these holes and being like, all right, we planned this storyboard to be here. Does that actually work? And most of the time it did. There were some times though, I was like, oh, this didn't quite cut like we thought it would. Maybe we need a new shot. Maybe we need this. And that I think was something that was helpful because it's something that Jason's never done on any of his other movies.
Mm. And so did you cut storyboard animatics?
There were just raw storyboards. Jason tried to do a little previs, but it didn't jive with him as much. And then storyboards turned out to be somewhere I had a lot of fun putting sound effects and music to these boards months and months ahead of time to really try to get tone and pace and the vibe. And it was incredibly collaborative to sort of be like, well, what if we had a shot that did this and the storyboard artist would draw it, send it to me, and I put it in. And it turned out to be like this animated film that was one frame per second. And then all that music and sound effects actually transferred. We brought it into the Avid. So when I started cutting the scenes, I used the same stuff. And then that informed even Rob's music in the end is tonally consistent with what I started doing almost exactly 3 years ago, January 2019.
That's crazy. 3 years. So you mentioned music.
Let's talk about temping, because as a Ghostbusters fan, I mean, there are two movies that I've probably seen more than any other movie in the world. Blues Brothers and Ghostbusters. Those are my two.
And now you could add three.
Now, I'm going to
Ghostbusters Afterlife.
I swear I'm going to see this movie 20 times this year. I loved it.
Perfect.
That
Thank
much.
You.
So the question is, I recognize a lot of at least themes from the original Ghostbusters. So what did you use to temp with? And did you go outside of the composer's realm? Did you go outside of the Ghostbusters universe to temp?
Nate, you could talk more about this, because generally I don't cut a lot with temp music, but Nate does. And I think you did such a fantastic job with our temp and being able to communicate that to our music editor and all of that. So you take this question.
Thank you. I do have to say that there's so much value, and also the cut has to work without music. The cut has to work on silent. I like cutting with temp music because I like it in the tone and the headspace, but especially action, you got to put it on mute and every cut has to be smooth. Otherwise you're leaning on it and then all of a sudden it's not actually a good cut. It's just a good music.
And in dialogue scenes too. I mean, that's partly why I don't cut with music at all, because I think music needs to enhance the cut, not dictate the cut. But yes, I agree with what you're saying, Nate.
But no, regarding the temp music, we obviously had every note of the original score, which we discovered is not that much. Hmm. It's kind of funny. I think there was one fan or someone talking to someone at the Friends and Family who asked, so how much new music is there? And it's like, it's all new music.
Yeah.
It gives the feeling, and Jason wanted it to feel like it was all this uncovered stuff that Elmer did. But Rob did just an incredible job expanding. And so he would send us, before we started shooting, to get the job or like to prove that Rob really, really knew what he was doing, he did a suite, a 10-minute suite that incorporated Elmer's stuff, incorporated new stuff, went through all these tonal shifts and notes. And it's like 10 minutes of this beautiful suite, which, gosh, I wish that we could just put that on soundtrack. But it's so reminiscent and so accurate to what we ended up doing. But he did it in May before we started shooting. So we had this vision of where we were going. And then so he would start doing these sketches and we'd put that in the edit. I would use temp from Elmer. We'd put stuff in. We'd try to use these John Williams cues from movies that you don't recognize John Williams. Because using temp music is always dangerous when you're like, hey, that's Indiana Jones. You don't want that feeling.
Exactly. Try temping anything from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh,
you instantly go, whoa, wait a minute. What movie am I in?
No. Hidalgo is the move or something like that, where you don't immediately recognize the score. But no, it was a very difficult process, to be honest, because it's such a specific tone. And the savior was those sketches that Rob would send over, these early sketches. For instance, the basement scene when Phoebe's going through the basement, and there's these specific beats that, like, cutting that scene without music is like, okay, she's flashlights on, boom, things are on, here's some mushrooms, here's some wind, here's the thing. But with music, it's like, slow down. Beat, bing, bing, bing. And there's this rhythm to it that's like what we talk about with comedic timing, but it's this sort of weird Ghostbusters tone that's not horror and not thriller, but it's tense but not overly scary. It's a very specific feeling that I think Jason really knew in his heart, like what he wanted it to feel like.
Rob just nailed it. I mean, I told him that on Wednesday night. His score is so beautifully done and so specific and incorporates Elmer's themes with a little bit of his own stuff, and just the blend of the two worlds is, I'm blown away by it.
Same.
Pretty impressive.
I've got a t-shirt that I made for one of my post-production crews, and it's 10 commandments of editing. And one of the 10 commandments is temp not with John Williams. He composes not for thee.
I love it. That's great.
That's awesome. Send that over to us. I like that.
You got it.
We were trying to find the music that Spielberg's films tempt with so that it was one generation removed.
There was an incredible little sequence of edits when Phoebe, right, puts the backpack on and they're out in the...
At the foundry.
Yeah, at the foundry, and she lights that thing up and fires it for the first time. Talk to me about pacing that. And also so much of it is about the sound that the backpack makes and all that kind of stuff.
A lot of that sound is from the original.
Yeah.
Most of it, right?
That one specifically, I think, was a very intricate hybrid where Will Files took apart the original
and put it back
together. A lot of the other stuff was, but that one specifically, because it was supposed to be like, this is turning on for the first time, so it's a little rougher. Mm-hmm. So it was supposed to be expanded out, like it's really getting going. And we had all these little switches and flips and stuff. But that was the first day of production, actually.
I was there for that.
That was the first scene I cut. Yeah, that was fun.
That's a blast. Would that be one of those scenes where you feel like, even though maybe it's not a lot of music, I don't remember score through there, it probably is, but I remember mostly sound effects. Do you have to take the sound effects off to feel, did I get this right?
I'm trying to remember. What's weird is I don't think that cut changed that much.
I don't think so either. A couple of tweaks here and there, just in terms of camera angles, but the timing of it, I mean, I think it pretty much stayed fairly close to the original cut of it.
Will, I mean, that was the intent, was to fill this up, and then Will Files and Perry Robertson just sort of infused all that space. That was a rhythm thing, a timing thing, where we just wanted to be like, and here we go. But yeah, that was something we cut on mute because we didn't have that sound effect.
Yeah.
Well, I also think of needing to leave space for it. Like you were saying, how it hasn't been turned on for a long time. So the first time the button goes on, you gotta wait long enough, I think, to go, what do you have to do? Do you have to imagine it in your head? Okay, that thing's going. Yeah.
That's just me going like, I'm sure like the assistants think I'm crazy, where I'm like on the keyboard, I'm like, I'm just sitting there by
myself.
That was
that sound that I heard exactly. Through the walls.
Yeah, I do the same thing. You got to do the sound effects with your mouth.
I just talk to the screen. I don't necessarily do sound effects, but I just talk to the screen. I talk to the actors all the time.
Yeah. And you just hold that to stay there longer.
Yeah.
The camera focus puller. Just pull focus. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. I talk to everybody.
Yeah, the director. You couldn't have called cut 3 seconds later.
Exactly.
So the use of close-ups, I was just really cognizant that you guys almost saved them for a critical moment in the film where there's some nice, big, beautiful close-ups. Talk to me about the value of close-up in a scene and when you don't go to it and when you feel like it's okay.
Well, I think in a typical dialogue scene, you want to build to a certain point. And that's when the close-ups really count. When you're having a dialogue, you might do a traditional start wide, go in a little bit tighter. And then when something of great importance is said, you want to be in for a close-up. That's the general idea of, to me, the value of a close-up. When you want to make an impact, when you want to emphasize something of importance or of just a reaction.
Yeah. For me, one of the values of close-ups, and I completely agree with what Dana said, that you want to build to these moments. And they're not always at the end. Sometimes in the middle of the scene, and then you pull back wide. One of my tricks I realized, I don't think I realized until the film after Ghostbusters that I did, that it was like, oh, I do this a lot, is I'll often throw the close-up, and this is totally tied into starting after a comma, not after a period, is that in the middle of a scene, I'll cut to the close-up of the character I want to be inside their head, and then I'll cut wide. So my first shot will be a close-up. The perfect example is Trevor sitting down in the mine. He steps on the wood board. It's like a kind of weird creep. And then we cut to Trevor, and then we cut wide. And I just wanted to be in his head. I didn't want to lose tension and lose POV. And so that's, to me, some important value of close-ups. There's that famous cut in Boogie Nights. It's wide shots, chaos in this drug lord's house when they're selling cocaine. Music's blasting. And then halfway through the scene, it just cuts to this tight close-up of Mark Wahlberg. It just cuts this tight close-up, and you're like, oh my God. The effectiveness of that is off the charts.
Dana, you mentioned doing some short films for Jason.
So when I was an assistant editor on many of Ivan Reitman directed films, at the end of the day, Jason would come into our cutting room and use our Avids to cut his short films. I was often there late, and he would ask me questions and I would help him out. I never actually cut one of his short films, but I definitely helped him out with a bunch of stuff on the Avid.
Have either of you cut any shorts recently? And what's the value of that for you?
Recently, no.
Yeah.
No.
Just curious.
Shorts are hard. I honestly think shorts are sometimes harder than features in some ways.
How so?
I think in order to have an actual arc, it's funny, I've been actually watching Cowboy Bebop, the animated series, to prepare for the live action because I have friends that worked on it. And I'm just in 22 minutes, the first episode, I'm just absolutely shocked at the efficiency of storytelling. Uh-huh. One shot for 3 seconds, I learned so much about this world and the characters. Short films are like that, where you have to be that efficient. In a feature, you get to settle in, have some popcorn, and enjoy these quiet moments that you can develop arcs slower over time. It's kind of like the difference between features and long form series, where you can have these long, big arcs.
That makes sense. Like act one of a feature is your first 2 minutes of a short.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So a great short to me is just incredible. But yeah, it's been a long time since I've cut one.
And somebody that cut one recently, a fairly big editor, had cut a short film, and I asked this question, and they were like, well, I love it because they're not usually three-act structures even. A lot of times it's one act, literally, and it's just quick storytelling. And as you said, how efficient can you be in your storytelling? So it's a practice. It's a learning tool almost.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the structure of the film. One of the things that I sensed, maybe because I wanted so much more, you know how fans are where you're like, I wish this movie was 6 hours long. Right? No, you don't. You don't.
Exactly.
I do wish it was 6 hours long, but I was wondering whether there were parts of some of the characters' stories that got left for efficiency's sake, either the mom and the Paul Rudd character, their relationship, or Finn's character and his girlfriend. Did any of that get trimmed?
I mean, there was a lot of stuff that expanded on Callie and her relationship with her father.
Oh, right.
And Callie even with her relationship with Phoebe. But just like we were talking about with short films, is that what do you really need? What do you really need to tell the story? And if you have the beats there, it's what the movie's, what's the final runtime? It's like 2 hours, right?
With credits, I think it's just under or just over 2 hours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, same thing like you said, you think you want more and you don't. Sometimes you feel like you shoot these movies and you're capturing all this stuff. It's just then you keep sifting to find the best nuggets.
And we played around with putting scenes back in and watching the movie and actually even living with those scenes that we had taken them out. Then we put them back in, then living with them back in, and then realizing it just didn't do anything to keep the story moving. And so we took them out again, and all for the better of the final product.
You mentioned Callie, some scenes with her and her dad. And I have to say, I cried at the end of the movie. I literally had tears streaming down my face. So I definitely connected with the character. But the danger, right, is that if you cut those scenes out about her and her dad, then you lose the power of the connection.
I respectfully disagree.
Yeah.
Because first off, the scenes that we're talking about are just about her relationship with her father, and they actually had scenes with Annie Potts talking about it.
Mm.
I think the more ambiguous the relationship is, the more you put your individual self in it. Like I talked to my dad this morning. He was telling me, he's like, this made me think of my dad and I miss him so much.
That just gave me the chills.
Right? And so the less there is, the more you put your own, it's like a Rorschach test.
Yeah, I buy that. Okay.
But here's the other thing about how this movie is. We stripped things down, but we didn't necessarily take them out. Because when Callie goes downstairs into the basement, you get that sense of connection that she felt lost and she felt that he didn't care about her.
Yeah.
But, and I'm sorry if this is a spoiler, but you realize that he did. Mm-hmm. And so you still get that connection. We left enough in there that you can still emotionally connect with, even if you don't put yourself in it, you realize what's going on. And so we didn't take it out completely.
No, yeah. So, you know, I mean, like it's the nitty gritty details that I think sometimes when you read a script, you're like, well, I didn't understand the mechanics of when did this happen in her past? And so there's scenes that explain stuff. That's the details I'm talking about that are not as important as if you accomplish that arc, like Dana just said, great.
I mean, you guys definitely had me. I'm saying that emotionally, I had enough material to have it affect me by the end.
Right.
But that's the danger, right? That's the scary thing when you're cutting stuff out is if we lose too much of this, does it hurt us when we finally get to the end? It helps you at the beginning because you're like, oh, we're cutting stuff out. We're moving the thing along. But then you're like, will there be enough for the audience to hold on to?
Right.
Well, it certainly was for me. The other thing that I'm really fascinated with is a movie like this, obviously great writing, a huge development cycle probably of many people that were very wise speaking into the script. And yet there are scenes that you shoot that you think you need that everybody thought you needed, or else they would have been cut before that you shot them. But they end up getting cut. And that's just so interesting to me that that can happen. Can you talk about either seeing the value in it and then understanding what changes between a script and when they're shot and when you guys get them in the editing room? How does a movie change from writing to shooting to editing? too big of a question?
No, not too big of a question. Just trying to figure out how to answer it.
It's just such a different beast. I always thought that the script is like reading an owner's manual to a car. It's extremely cold and descriptive. And if you can read it and have feelings, then that means it's successful at its job. But you're not in the car. You're not driving it. Heads and tails of scenes are a perfect example where you think you need to understand why this character walked into this room. But then when you're there, you're just like, no. We just cut to them and we buy it. Or there's things you can sell in a look that is so emotive. You couldn't have written, and then Callie did this look that made you feel this way, and thus we don't need this whole other scene. That's the magic of capturing these humans on film or pixels or whatever.
I love it. How did you guys collaborate? Did any scenes go back and forth between the two of you, or was it pretty much you work on your own scene?
A lot of them did. Originally, it was that I was going to focus on more of the conversational character development, character driven scenes, and Nate was going to focus on more of the heavy visual effects action sequences. And that's how it really started. But then once we got into post-production, after filming ended and Jason started working with us, we really fed off of each other. Sometimes I couldn't crack a scene, and so Nate would take it and do a version of it. Or sometimes Jason wanted to get another perspective of something and go into Nate's room and say, let's work on this for a minute. But that's the advantage of having two editors. Sometimes there are movies with two or more editors where it's very specific. You do this, you do that, you do that. With us, we were involved in each other's stuff all the time. Whether it's Nate, can you take a crack at this? Or Dana, can you take a crack at this? Or let's work on this together. Two, whenever we would review stuff, Nate would kind of come into my room with Jason. I would go into Nate's room with Jason. Sometimes, you know, if Jason wasn't there, we'd bring our assistants in to get their perspective. And so editing to me, 150% is a collaboration between the entire team that's working on it, from pre-production and prep to production to post-production. You can't have a successful movie without everybody's expertise being put into it.
Totally. Some of my favorite scenes are ones that flipped. Things that I was kind of stuck in my head on a certain way to do it. Mm-hmm. And then Dana took a crack at it and it's like, great.
Yeah, same.
And then the other scenes are like, we found a B cam of a certain thing and it's flipped the entire scene to the other side of the line. And then it was like a whole different scene. And just having two editors, having two perspectives, we would lean on each other constantly. It felt really, really good to have a partner, mm-hmm. to have someone that I loved and trusted and I could show something to, because when we showed the movie to Jason, it was Dana and I showing the movie that we did to Jason. It was together. And so there's sequences that every cut we've talked about.
Yeah.
Every single one.
Yep.
I love it. And then let's talk about the collaboration of when the movie's assembled and then you're not passing scenes back and forth and trying to break a scene, but you're trying to decide, hey, do we cut out this story with Annie Potts? And what's that going to mean to the two scenes on either side of it? Do those cut back together now that that scene's gone?
That was a lot of communication. Deciding all of that was an ongoing conversation that goes back to, do we put this scene back in? And we would put it back in and try it for a while and realize that it didn't work. And so in our cutting room on the hallway, we had one wall left on the cutting room floor and another wall with scene cards of every reel, and things just kept going back and forth and back and forth from one wall to another. So yeah, it's a conversation that is ongoing. Do we need this? Do we not need this? But it's a conversation that is held with everybody. And we would have meetings in the hallways, literally with
our assistants. That's what I was gonna ask. Was there a lot of conversations in the hallways?
Yeah, a lot of hallway conversations with Jason, our assistants, everybody would sort of get involved and give their two cents. And it's collaborative.
One of the first things I told Dana was, I'm not afraid to be wrong. When I'm wrong, I will do a 180-degree turn, march in the opposite direction. And a perfect example of that, and this is the opposite, of instead of putting scenes back in and then realizing, yeah, we don't need them, at one point we started the movie way later. Still had the opening sequence, but we started the movie at the arrival of the house. And I was a proponent of that, being like, look, you figure out all the information, you throw your audience in the middle of it. And I was very wrong.
I was kind of talked into that. I was a little bit against that because I felt like you needed more of an introduction with the family. But yeah, go on, Nate.
No, it's because that was a very interesting way to introduce your characters, is have them arrive at the house that they inherited. You didn't throw them into the perspective of the film. So for a little while, we had that whole opening gone. And it broke the characters. It breaks the movie. It was. But you have to do that. I always say you have to drive off the cliff to understand where the edge is.
I love all your analogies.
That's a great quote, and as is the car manual.
Yeah.
User manual.
You're going to use that in your next interview.
Yeah, absolutely. You guys got to save some stuff exclusive for Steve Hallfish and Art of the Cut. You just got to come up with some new analogies that are not as good for other people. That's
okay. We'll work on that.
All right. I really love the idea that, because I've seen movies where, you know, it's a single mom and the kids, and they just start, they're on the road. You don't see all the backstory, but it's very interesting that it doesn't work, that you try it and you feel like it doesn't work.
And going back to the point of trying to decide to cut a scene or not, to me, the most important thing that's really, really hard to even convey to very general audiences, and I say this to people that are trying to understand what I do for a living when I meet them, is every movie you've ever seen was almost twice as long. And it's not just scenes that were left out. It's trims. Every scene was probably twice as long in its assembly form.
Yeah.
And so deciding what scenes should completely go, but then even the harder task to me is, how do you trim these down? These scenes that don't need to be that long, and going back to when a performance is really good and you can lean on it and you don't need all this other stuff, that's very, very hard. And that's one of the reasons that in the early assembly form, when we panicked at the length and I was like, let's jettison the whole opening. But that's not what we needed to do. It just needed to be tight.
I remember standing at our continuity wall and being like, these two reels will eventually come down to one. And it was like a huge argument, not an argument, but like huge discussion that, no, there's no way we could cut that down. Sure enough, after a while, just little trims here and there and taking things out. And when music started coming, those two reels ended up to be one.
And Dana, there was one great one early on, because we had this assembly of the whole third act or something like that. And it was like 25 minutes. And we just shot it. I just got back from Calgary, which, by the way, important to be there, like we were talking about, to put all these pieces together and be there for it. But at the detriment of exactly what Dana said earlier about you don't necessarily have that third perspective. And I needed to be there just from a geography perspective on this blue screen of a farmhouse. It was mind-numbing. But a little bit lost in the weeds. And so assembly, I think, was 25 minutes long. And I was like, okay, this has got to get under 20. This has got to get under 20. And I think Dana was like, 13, 15 minutes. I was like, what? That can't be that short. That's impossible. I think it's within 12 and a half, 13 minutes in the final version of the movie.
It's so funny. And those numbers, granted, we're kind of pulling them out of a hat. They're general numbers.
Yeah,
the point being, losing 5 to 7 minutes out of a sequence is a lot.
But I just remember you were very right.
Very right. Yeah.
Thank you.
I love the idea that it is important as an editor to be able to be wrong.
100%.
Yeah. And that's hard for me. I got to say, when I cut a scene and a director's not happy with it or something like that, it hurts.
I'm not saying being wrong
doesn't hurt.
There have been plenty of times where you just feel completely defeated when the director's not happy with what you did, because you have put so much time and effort into it with finding certain beats and finding certain moments and crafting this, what you feel is this beautiful scene. And it is beautiful. It's just not what the director had in mind for what they wanted to put out there. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's not easy.
No.
It's not easy to be wrong in anything in life, right? But the important lesson is to accept it and then go and collaborate and make it better.
And to me, our jobs are to, like, okay, Let's try this. And in my head, I'm like screaming. I probably don't do a good job of this, but I try. I put this so much effort. This is how it goes. And then we rework the scene, and the director's happy with it. And to me, when I say I'm happy to be wrong, it's not that I'm instantly can pivot. It's that I have to be open at the end of that. When the director says, this is what I'm looking for, I have to be open and not have an ego about anything else and be like, yeah, this is better. And once I think it's better and I'm open to that and I accept it, that's when I'm like, this is the way it needs to be. And I'm a huge proponent of that vision. But your heart has to be open. Otherwise, it's just ego and it's not pleasant for anybody.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, our job as editors is not just to collaborate, but to also bring the director's vision to the screen. And so it's not all about us.
Yeah.
It's about bringing a particular vision to the audiences nationwide around the world and to be happy and proud of what we've done.
Absolutely. I'm intrigued by the idea that you saw this 20-minute sequence and thought it should be 13 or 12 and a half or whatever it is. I had an old boss that I would do stuff like that, and he would go, you can't do things by the numbers. But you're not doing things by the numbers, right? You're seeing the scene and you know, because of experience, because of what else you know about that sequence, that you can probably cut it by a third or something like that.
Yeah. And that's when I say the numbers are just arbitrary. It's just pulling numbers out of a hat. But the point being is the 20 to 25 minute version of it felt way too long and way too embellished. And 13 to 15 was just to say the 20 to 25 is too long and we need to take a lot out.
Absolutely. Love that. Tell me, for each of you, how do you approach a scene when you are looking at dailies on something like that? You've got this great footage, right? Great performances that you loved. Are you go into a bin and look at individual scenes? Are you a chem roll kind of person? Do you create selects? What do you do?
I would, if I hadn't had two jobs already since Ghostbusters, I would not be admitting this is my process, because I don't watch dailies. I think it's a waste of my own emotional energy, because there's diminishing returns after I watch the same line over and over again, or I watch a whole clip, a whole scene over and over and over again. So what I do is I methodically go from the top beat and start cutting without ever seeing the end of the scene on any take or whatever. Obviously, I reread this scene in the script really quickly. I look at the notes on the editor's log, but I use, if it's a dialogue scene, I use script view a lot. And I just keep comparing each beat across the board on every setup and go with my gut of like, this feels like I really need to be in this shot level, or this performance is really good. And then I'm like, oh, now I really want to cut to like a wide. And then I just keep snaking my way through the scene until I get to the end. And then I go back and look at it. What did I miss? Did I get anything? And I recheck all the audio takes and swap out any performances I want, etc. That's my process. But it's very to me like, oh my God, I don't watch dailies. I do. I just slowly do it as I go.
I totally get that.
Do it over time.
Mm-hmm. It's a brave thing to say, because a lot of people, and everybody I talk to says, oh, I watch every moment of every daily. Well, that's great. Most of us do, right? By the end, eventually. I do like to cut where, for example, wide shots. So you've got six wide shot takes. Why should you watch six wide shots from beginning to end? You know that you're only going to use that wide shot in a certain place, maybe there's a nice vocal performance or something in there, but why watch all of that? Eventually you might, because you find the great wide shot and you go, oh, I wonder where I can use this. But yeah, I get it.
My process is a bit different. I do watch dailies, but what I do is I watch one take of each setup, usually the last take. Sometimes I'll look at the first take and the last take, but usually the last take of each setup, just so I know in my head what I have to work with. And then I go through, a lot of editors will have their assistants do a string out of line reads, but I like doing my own. And the reason being is usually I have found that when assistants do string outs for editors, they go right from the line as opposed to a lead into the line. And I like to find special moments. When another character is talking, there's certain looks and reactions that I could find that I could use as a reaction for something else. And so I make my own string out of lines, sort of like a chem roll. And then I take that camera roll. So basically I have two or three different choices of the same setup, and then two or three different choices of a line of another setup, and then two or three choices of a line of another setup. And then I go to the next line and find, and then that's how I compare. I take that camera roll, make a copy of it, and then that's where my sequence begins. And I start cutting out things that I don't like. So it's back-to-back reads of a certain line in different setups. And I decide what read I like best and what angle I like best for that line at that particular moment. Now, if I am not sure how to start a scene, I'll start in the middle and work my way to the end and then go back to the beginning, because I know where I want to end. I know kind of where I want to be in the middle, but I have no clue how to start it because there's so many different ways. And so I do the beginning of a scene last. Not always, but sometimes.
That's a discipline I have a hard time, is I have not been able to start in the middle of the scene. I don't know how. That's really good. And those, but the special moments you talk about, one of the reasons I got frustrated when I would watch all of the dailies religiously was that I don't know what I need yet.
Yeah.
And then I would find these great performances, these special moments, then I got really attached to, and I was like, actually, this is not useful.
Right.
But then later on, I'd go digging and I'd find, be able to repurpose this thing for this thing. And oh my God, oh, look at this gem. This is great. But like, I only knew what I needed after I had assembled the scene.
Yep.
And my process changes all the time, just in terms of swapping out takes, to your point, Nate, just in terms of, oh, this read isn't right for this moment, so let me go back and look at others. But I have my string out chem roll to go back and look at other takes that I actually like line reads of.
Right.
I don't use, unless I'm in a complete rush, I don't use Scripter in the Avid to actually do my assembly, because I find that I miss those gems of certain moments.
Right.
But it does come in handy later on when I'm working with the director and they say, let me see all the line reads for such and such line. I was trying to think of a line from Ghostbusters, but my brain didn't think that fast.
I just think of the triangle joke about being obtuse or something like that.
Yeah.
Love that.
Let me see all the lines of obtuse and the wink.
Yeah. Well, we did do that. Jason wanted to see all those lines. And I think the one that we originally had in is what's in the movie, because yeah, that was the best.
Absolutely.
We all agreed on that.
Yes. And honestly, we all agreed on most things. It was just us banging our heads against the wall trying to figure out what to lose, because we loved a lot of it.
That was probably one of the hardest things, is to figure out what to lose. And there's a lot that was left on the cutting room floor.
Do you know how long the first cut was?
Oh, God. I could look on my pictures.
Oh, really. Yeah. Sure. Let's see it.
Assembly was 256.
256. Okay. Wow. That's good. Yeah.
Yep.
There was a long sequence. There's more jokes that Phoebe told at the stairs. And it was very long. Because I just cut every joke in, and because they shot a lot of jokes to find the best one. And we're just like, so we're watching the assembly with the assistants, and it turns into like a comedy club.
Yeah. We used whichever ones we all laughed at the most.
Exactly.
I love it. Nathan, tell me a little bit about the VFX, because it sounded like a lot of those sequences were going to fall to you, even if they didn't eventually. Tell me about trying to pace that stuff when you don't have VFX, when the VFX haven't been done. Are you working with previs or postvis, or is it your imagination?
Combination. We did not have any previs. We had some postvis, but oftentimes, for instance, the Muncher Chase, that sequence that I did the boards on, I cut out. This is before our wonderful VFX editor was able to do some very good temps, but I did a cutout of Muncher from the storyboards. And so it looked like a 2D little Mario ghost. Then I would keyframe in Avid. And so it just had to take it 100% seriously. And it was so silly. It looks so stupid. It looks like a Roger Rabbit's going through town. And it was just me just keyframing stuff. The big lesson that I learned was sort of, and I don't know how I would do this next time differently, but my instinct on the film was to keep shots longer VFX wise. Especially since what happened organically is that I'd have a title explaining what's happening and you need time to read that. And I figured it's better to have something longer and we trim than try to have a shot that's really quick and you're like, what the hell is going on? So what we end up is most of these shots got so much shorter that I do think it'd be better to have some previs next time in some of these sequences so that the shot length doesn't change that much as it did in some of these sequences where I kept things longer than they needed to be. Because like you're saying, pace is really hard to determine when there's no character there.
Mm-hmm. Or no fantastic visual, right? Like when you have a fantastic visual, you're like, oh my gosh, I would love to be looking at this amazing wide shot or crazy ghost or whatever it is. But then you don't know that until you see the crazy ghost.
Yeah. That's why the puppet in Walmart was so much fun to cut, because it was there. It was just like, that was easy. And I thought it was funny. It'd be like, I chuckle myself almost every time because Dana and I have talked a lot about cuts on blinks. And so we cut on both on the behind, because it's something that Dana and I have also talked about, is like sometimes even subconsciously you don't realize that you're on the reverse of someone and you can cut on the blink of the person that's out of focus. We do that with the Terror Dog on behind, and we cut on the blink on the front. And I was like, this is fun to cut on blinks with like puppets.
That's hilarious.
Walter Murch is going to be so happy right now.
I do want to recognize our incredible team in our post department. So we had Mike Fay as our first assistant, Nick Ellsberg as our second assistant, Ali Andrus as an assistant editor, as well as Tom Cabella as our visual effects editor, and Jeff Mee as our visual effects assistant editor. And could not have asked for a better team. In addition to Kurt Sobel, our music editor, who has worked with Rob Simonson on a number of projects. And so our team really became a family. And we would sit after hours, sit in my cutting room and drink whiskey and do puzzles together, because we just loved being together, and the trust that we had with one another and the respect that we have for one another could not be any better than it was and still is. And both Nate and I thank all of them tremendously.
We went through the pandemic together, and that was to me a huge thing. And I can't imagine a better crew to have gone through that together.
Absolutely.
But most of the cutting was pre-pandemic, right? Most of it changed
considerably after the pandemic, but mainly just trims and sharpening. Like I think Dana said previously, there was a version before we went into the pandemic that we're very happy with the movie because we were going to come out that July. But having extra time and even a little distance from it and then coming back to it really let us make it as sharp as possible.
I think every movie should be made that way.
Just like step away for a month. Everybody go to like Mykonos or something.
And yeah, Mykonos.
But
that was very specific, Nathan.
Yeah, I know.
I was just in Europe, and that's where everyone went to holiday. It was very interesting.
Awesome.
You became very European because you say everyone went to holiday.
That's right.
Vacation.
I got food delivery the other day. I opened the door and I was like, bonsoir.
That's awesome. No, but our team was just top notch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did watch all the credits. I saw Sobel in there. I saw Zimmerman in there.
Yep.
Fantastic.
And even our sound team.
Yeah.
Will Files, Perry Robertson were our sound supervisors. And Will Files and Mark Patterson were our mixers. And everybody, just the entire team, can't be more proud than I am right now.
Absolutely. And I know Will Files from back in the day at Bad Robot. So him and I go way back. So it was very much a joy to work with him in his capacity on this movie, because like me, he grew up with the stuff. And then to be able to play in this sandbox is just a joy. Like we were saying, the first scene that they shot and the first thing that I cut was the one with Phoebe turning on the proton pack and firing. And like we said, that scene actually, I don't think changed that much at all.
We turned that scene over to Will and Perry and the entire sound team early, like back in December.
Yeah. Real's the
first
one.
They came to our cutting room and we actually sat and watched that scene and talked about what Jason wanted and Jason's vision, and really, really, really early on they were involved.
Mm. Do you still have the Avid project for Ghostbusters?
No, we turned it over, but I emailed you our timeline.
Perfect. Okay. I was really interested in seeing specifically the timeline for that proton pack.
Oh.
There was something about the editing of that just, and I only saw it once, so it was very quick, but I really loved that little sequence of that proton pack. The other great timeline would be the opening chase of Muncher through the town is also a great
scene. Muncher chase. Jason's favorite scene.
It is a great sequence.
I think I recently saw an interview that he was like, I could watch that scene every single day for the rest of my life.
Oh, I need to watch that. That's great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I'll see if I can find it. I'll send it to you.
Thanks. Thank you so much for all your time. And I just love this movie. Thank you so much for cutting it. And thanks for chatting with me.
Thank you so much, Steve. This was a joy.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the art and craft of editing. Thanks to my guests, Dana Glauberman, ACE, and Nathan Orloff. Also, thanks to Jake Gum for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their continued support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.